matter of thinking. There is no distinct difference in suddenly becoming ionizing or non-ionizing radiation. Is there a sudden difference where you go from one frequency to another frequency and all of a sudden it becomes a radio frequency biohazard? Every zoning board in the United States is very scared about the fact that the new antennas about to be installed in their town are microwave antennas, putting out RF radiation, that R word. We no longer use the N word, it's improper. It's time we stop using the R word, radiation. It confuses the hell out of people. We should call it microwave, we should call it radio transmission, radio emission, radio signaling. Give it any other word but radiation, because people confuse it with nuclear radiation. Radio is not plutonium. The so-called microwave frequency region above 1.5 gigahertz, pound for pound, is 5 to 1 safer than VHF, 300 megacycles. Of course, that's opposite of common sense. What's happening above 1.5 gigahertz is that 20% of the RF energy penetrates your body, 80% reflects off of your skin. At 300 megacycles, a high percentage penetrates your skin and gets turned into heat. So 300 megacycles is almost 5 to 1 less safe than 1500. The microwaves are safer. You say those words in front of a zoning board, and they'll say, what in the world are you smoking? All of these years, we were told that microwaves mean cancer and it's unsafe. They've got it backwards. They don't understand what's really going on. So don't be afraid of microwaves. A good buddy of mine, Dr. Tom Williams of the A1 MBA, puts on the bottom of every one of his emails, no frequency is high enough. He's a progressive thinker. At every single point in time, the next band up in frequencies were given to the ham radio operators because everyone believed they were useless. That's how we got the HF band in the first place. AM broadcast used to exist around 1.5 megacycles, and the frequencies from 3.5 megacycles up were considered useless, and they were given to ham radio operators. And boy, did we prove how useful they are. Well, that scenario gets repeated every 10 or 15 years, over and over again. And right now, for instance, we are given a 500 megacycle region of 10 gigahertz. You build equipment anywhere between 10.0 and 10.5 gigahertz, and you're allowed to use that band essentially any way you want to, 500 megacycles wide. You could, if you want to, put 100 television transmitters in there, fast scan television. A lot of spectrum. Everyone thinks it's useless. A few years from now, it's going to be considered very valuable real estate. 50 years ago, Florida was considered one great big swamp that you had to drain. It was a useless chunk of land. Try buying a piece of it today. 30 years ago, if you tried to declare a frequency allocation at 10,000 megacycles, nobody would give you any flack. Go there and do anything you want. A few years from now, it's going to be considered valuable real estate. That's my prediction. I think I'm off subject, but maybe it helps. K2KUI, KQLIW.
K2Tech.
Go ahead, then, Eric.
Yeah, you're going to find that both sides of 10 gigahertz is encroached. There's a lot of stuff on both sides of it. I mean, it's pretty jam-packed between the broadcasters and some other stuff that's there. And the other thing is, I just recently ordered what used to be a TWT, HPA, an SSPA that puts out 600 watts at 12 gigahertz. And it's a pretty small mount. And, it actually mounts outside by the dish that it's going to go on. Oh, and by the way, do you have anything for 902?
Oh boy, do I have stuff for 902. And you and I got to talk on the telephone, now that's so good. I'm going to reinterpret the words. Eric gave you a whole lot of abbreviations. He talked about his SSPA and TWTA and so on. Around 10 gigahertz, not too many years ago, the only way to develop power in that band is a velocity modulator, very fancy tube called traveling wave tube that required something like a 10,000 volt power supply at a fraction of an ampere in order to get gain and power output. Very fancy, very expensive tube, $20,000 type tube is what was required not too many years ago. Now you can buy an SSPA, solid-state power amplifier. There are transistors that'll put out almost any amount of power you want at that frequency, an extremely small package compared to the way we used to do it with the PWT. So we've come a long way. I think that's essentially what you were saying with all of your abbreviations. Back to you. By the way, you do believe in UAA, don't you, Eric?
Yeah, I suppose I do. Well, actually, maybe I should send you an email because if you got any stuff around 9:20 that can listen at them, you'll find some interesting things going on. That's something Andy and I are working on. Yeah, well, I'll tell you, it's a long way from like 3 years ago or 4 years ago. If I was going to buy one of these things, it would still be a PWT. It's just amazing how the technology has changed overnight.
Okay, what I just asked, Eric, is do you believe in UAA? UAA stands for Use All Acronyms. See, there are a lot of people who will use a lot of acronyms and a lot of abbreviations, and quite often I'll ask them, do you believe in UAA? As long as people are speaking to each other and they understand all of the buzzwords and all of the acronyms, it works pretty well. But when you're talking to a general audience, sometimes you got to explain them. Let's have the next email, Mel, K2KEY, K2LAW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. I'm just laughing. So you're talking about new technology, and I'm just thinking about when I first started fooling around a little bit with so-called higher frequency 2 meters and up, and I bought a 2C39 tube that was sold surplus for, I don't know, 75 cents, and it came with a disclaimer warning me about the possibility of damage to my eyes and, I don't remember, a whole bunch of disclaimers when using a 2C39 at the higher frequency.
That we've come a long way. That was in the days when we believed that the 2C39 was probably being used at like 1,200 megacycles, well into the microwave region. Everyone believed that microwaves meant cancer, that it was a lot more dangerous. There's one little bit of truth about that, and that is when you start getting up to frequencies like 1, 2, and 3 gigahertz and beyond, and you have to travel, you have to send a signal more than, let's say, about 50 feet, you're likely to be using a piece of waveguide instead of a piece of coax cable, simply because waveguide at those frequencies has significantly lower loss than usual pieces of coax cable. Now, a waveguide is a kind of a concentrator. You open up the end of a piece of waveguide while the transmitter is operating, and you look down that tube as if you're looking into the front end of the rifle of a gun. And yes, because the RF energy down there is highly concentrated straight into your eye, and you sit there for 6 minutes, there is a slim possibility you're going to heat up your eye enough and give yourself eye damage. So in that respect, it's a little bit more dangerous. But pound for pound, you use the exact same amount of effective radiated power at 10 gigahertz versus 300 megacycles, and the 10 gigahertz is going to be 5-to-1 more safe for the same number of watts of ERP, because 80% of it reflects off your skin. That was not known very many years ago. People were not reading the effective chapter of the ANSI report, ANSI, American National Standards Institute. That's the main IEEE body of smart people who have for 50 years been vehemently, rigorously studying RF energy and its effects on human beings. The C95 report of the ANSI, A-N-S-I, it's got a great big long title that will scare the hell out of you. It's the biological effects of RF energy or whatever. I can't even think of it from 300 KC to 300 gigahertz, I think is the name of the article. Anyhow, and it's a pretty thick article, too. It's got 450 references, and that is the main defining document for radio frequency biohazards for the United States. It is used by the Department of Defense. It's used by OSHA, NIOSH, all of your armed forces and whatever. Use that document as the main reference. The Bureau of Radiological Protection for the United Kingdom has a similar document, and each of the European countries have an extremely similar document. And all those people in those separate organizations are continuously comparing notes with each other to make sure they're all on the same page, and they're all getting the same results when they study what is isn't dangerous. The bottom line of all of that is that for 50 years they've been looking for the non-thermal effect of RF energy. There isn't any. I've got a story. When RF energy hits your body, it does nothing but create heating. Was that you, Eric, and were you saying something else?
Yeah, I've got two interesting stories if you want to hear them.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi, one is from a transmitter manufacturer. You've seen the transmitter I play with from you'll notice that the output section of it is all waveguides, and it's only at 500 megahertz, so that's big waveguide. But it has these ports on it, and this particular transmitter manufacturer, that put one of these in I think it was one of the South African countries. And they had a problem with this, the waveguide switch. And it has a step tuned point at the end, and one of the guys decided he was going to open it up and look into it and see why the switch wouldn't move. And it just so happened that the transmitter is it's about 80 kilowatts. And the studio was wondering why they were off the air, so they turned the transmitter back on. Anyway, the story goes is that the guy wound up, the vitreous humor in his eyes just clouded up after that. What do you think, Dave?
I think that is a thermal effect, Eric. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's one of the stories out there. The other interesting little tidbit is it's kind of meaningless to us talking about it, but there is a spot on the Empire State Building on the observation deck. If you were to take an RFR meter there, or one of these RFR safety badges, I guarantee you it will go off.
Understand. However, the current ANSI standard, the American standard for radio frequency biohazard, is that you must exceed a certain number of milliwatts per square centimeter, which depends on frequency and whether or not you're informed or uninformed about the transmitter being turned on and so on. But you exceed some number of milliwatts and you integrate that power for 6 minutes. So in theory, a person must stand in the bad spot for 6 solid minutes with his eyes open, looking at the antenna, and then he's at the threshold of alarm of the current American standard. Depending on who you talk to, the current American standard has either a 10 to 1 or a 100 to 1 safety factor built into it. The current American standard came about in the late 40s because they took a white rabbit with red eyes, clamped him into a fixture, and clamped him into in a way that held his eye open while somebody was dropping water into his eye to make sure it wouldn't dry out, and they blasted him with 100 milliwatts per square centimeter, and 24 hours later, he did have the beginning of a cataract. They found that the threshold of eye damage for that rabbit, which somewhat representative of a human being, because the eyes are somewhat similar in size, somewhat similar in composition. Now, would a human being with 100 milliwatts per square centimeter squirt it into his eye, which creates a significant amount of heating, and he would feel uncomfortable? Would a human being stare into that kind of a transmitter without moving for 6 solid minutes? If he's not being clamped down by that, like that rabbit, I doubt it. And our current standard now for an uninformed operator is either 1 milliwatt or 0.1 milliwatt per square centimeter when it takes 100 milliwatts to create damage. So you can see we've got a huge safety factor built into our standard. For that guy who was operating the waveguide switch and somebody turned on the transmitter in the studio and an 80 kilowatt or a 40 kilowatt transmitter turned on, he was in the world's biggest microwave oven with his head in it. Isn't that true, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, it is. Also, the transmitter, you know, saw that kind of visual and shut itself down, but it generated that power for something like 30 seconds or something of that nature. But, yeah, I wouldn't want to subject myself to that kind of thing. By the way, do you know a guy by the name of Richard A. Tell?
You'll have to spell that name because your audio has got a tiny bit of distortion and there's some noise in the background. Richard A. Tell is what it sounds like. A-T-E-L?
Richard Tell. T-E-L-L. He's sort of considered by the government and the broadcasters the RFR guru.
It used to be Mr. John Osipchuk of Raytheon Corporation. Has Pell replaced Osipchuk?
I believe so. I'm not sure if they, you know, I don't know if there was a direct connection there, but he's the one who essentially has been the consultant to the FCC, and actually most of the broadcasters have had a visit from him in terms of RF safety. They held a number of courses up at the World Trade Center, and he was a guy.
Okay.
WW.
Very good, Howie. Did he get a chance to make a measurement or have any of his staff make a measurement at the at the Empire State Building?
That gets done quite regularly, actually, by a bunch of different groups, by the MPBA, which is the Metropolitan TV Association, by Tell and his consultants, and also by the broadcast division of Empire State itself. It's gotten better since things have moved up to the mast, but there's some sticky places. But you know, the kind of RF levels we're talking about is I don't care about them.
Over the last week or so, I've seen Channel 2 go down to extremely low power outputs at 2 o'clock in the morning. Are they still doing construction on that mast?
Let's see. They finished reinforcing it, so that was a good thing. It took a long time before the weather. The bees are now in the center part of the mast. I think they just finished that up about 2 months ago. And then there's still some more other stuff going on, because there's just the DGB antennas are side mounted on the mooring mast, which is the lower part of it. And I think they're working on the low V's now, because I don't think they've got them finished yet.
Now, from what I'm hearing, the 8VSB technique, which is used in the United States for transmitting high-definition television, has a rather gentle threshold to it as you go out in range, whereas the European standard, which is, what can I think of the name of it now? Orthogonal OFDM. It's an OFDM technique, and I hear tell it's got an extremely sharp threshold.
It's called COFDM.
COFDM. As you go out to a mast system at some exact mileage, you go another mile, and all of a sudden the signal completely drops out. And for a short period of time, people were worried that the 8VSB system would be at the limit of range, a little bit vulnerable to multipath. What's the current thinking on multipath vulnerability, Europe versus the United States right now, Eric? Go ahead.
All right, let me give you the difference between the two of them. All right, 8VSB versus COFDM. COFDM is like having 1,000 little carriers, each one carrying a little bit of information, and you can, there's a training signal and there's a bunch of other stuff with it, whereas essentially it doesn't have problems with multipath like originally HVSV did. And we've had the discussion in the past about how you eliminate that problem, because in the HVSV, multipath can be, you get actually what we call a signal that is in advance of the main signal, right? Or it's a minus in time, if you want to think of it, in ghosting, that whole discussion. But the reality is now, the new stuff that's being manufactured, you can literally put the antenna on a moving vehicle and have it almost stay locked. So it's the receiver technology that's improving and making the difference. But the difference between COFDM and HVSD, okay, the United States is a very big country, and our grade B services can be pretty far away. Whereas in Europe, okay, the distance of one state or one grade B area actually can take you into a different country. So it actually takes more power, more electrical fuse. It's less efficient to transmit COFDM, and it's actually more efficient to transmit HVSB. Let me give you an example. In terms of our analog, my analog is 3/4 of a megawatt. okay, a VRP. My DTV rate, VSB signal, is 95 kilowatts VRP. Big difference.
Very nice. So that you're pretty happy with the system, and the fact that it's now not very vulnerable to multipath, does that mean many of the current receivers have the equivalent of a rake receiver, which is doing what they call a Z-domain transform? In other words, it is adjusting the individual components in time in order to put the signal back together and essentially cancel the multipath. Is that approximately what's going on, Eric?
Kind of, sort of. Not exactly. You can think of a delay line with many, many, many taps on it. Okay, and the idea is to try and figure out which is the main signal, and there's 8 bits of those main signals, because each that whole 6 megahertz wide transmits basically 8 bits of data in one fractional moment of time. So you have these 8 bits of data, and when you have these multipath reflections, it could look like 16 or 32. And the idea is to figure out which bits are the ones that you want. And because they're varying different points in time with the tap delay line, if you can figure it out, you can select the correct tap on the delay line to get the right step out.
Yeah, when I've seen the, what are they called now, transversal filter techniques, and when you've got a tap delay line and you take each of those taps and adjust the right coefficient and the right phase, in other words, in phase or out of phase, and the right coefficient of all those taps, and put it all together in a summing network, when that's properly adjusted, you essentially cancel all the multipath. That's what I think you're saying is going on. Now, my understanding of 8VSB is that it has 8 levels, not 8 bits of levels, 8 levels, which is 3 bits. In other words, you're getting 3 bits of signal per symbol being transmitted. Have I got that wrong?
No, you have it right. I said it wrong. Actually, the end result is some of those bits, okay, when you're talking about trellis and that sort of stuff, you actually strip away those in the end. The actual data that you're interested winds up being an 8-bit word.
So you're telling me there is a way that your constellation diagram test set will demonstrate the accuracy of what's being transmitted, and you're telling me there is the equivalent of 8 bits per symbol, not 3 bits per symbol, when it comes to the final video you get out?
Yeah, that's correct. There's 8 levels. Each level is got 3 it's got 3 bits of data in each symbol. Okay, whereas, like, if you're looking at QAM, okay, there's 256 levels. And I have to think about that, because I confuse myself about it. You pack more data per period of time, something's making noise here, than, right. Sorry about that.
Yeah, according to what you're talking about right now, you're almost ready to start saying the words of that FiOS advertisement. 20 dB true QAM, nice truck. You've seen that ad, haven't you, Eric?
Yeah, I have. All right. There was an AC on. That's why it's getting feedback. Sorry, that's throwing me for a loop. QAM with 256 symbols, okay, will give you a higher data rate than, say, VSB. But it's 3 bits per symbol, there's 8 sets of levels, and when you strip away the trellis and the turby, and the, there's another one. Oh, why isn't my brain working? The Reed Solomon, you wind up with 8 bits of data after all the corrections.
Yeah, the Viterbi he's talking about is a forward error correcting code invented by the Qualcomm company. And Reed Solomon is a technique of, let's say, being able to dig the signals out of noise. It's a variation of Reed Solomon encoding and decoding that's going on right now with the Sirius microwave amateurs. who are using the Joe Taylor techniques, the JT techniques as they're called. And so these guys are now sending signals off the moon or signals off of meteors that have minus 28 decibels of signal-to-noise ratio, and they're getting solid copy out of it. Whereas a man with a good set of earphones in that exact same environment would have a devil of a time copying anything beyond about minus 5 decibels of signal-to-noise ratio. So these guys are getting more than 20 dB of improvement by using the Joe Taylor techniques. You probably, of all the stuff you've been experimenting with, I haven't heard you experiment with that one yet, Eric. Go ahead.
Ah, okay. Not in the audio world. I don't know if you're aware, but there's a group of Germans. The Germans really, the hams there, they're really interesting. But what they've essentially done is taken something called CVB, okay, and it's CVBS, the CVB for satellite. It doesn't have as much of the error correction as the terrestrial version or even the cable version. And the reason for that is they're transmitting digital television using CVBS, which you can actually go out and buy one of those cheap little satellite receivers. And since the satellite receiver fits within the 902 to 1296 band, they can transmit digital television either on 1296, you don't have to buy any special converters, or in the 900 region, and all you got to do is tune the satellite receiver and you got pictures.
And is it similar to the satellite standards of FM modulation and a 30 meg channel width, or what's actually going on there, Eric?
No, it's not FM. It's COFDM, actually.
Okay. These guys are getting pretty big into it. Okay, I think Howie wanted to either ask a question on the subject on the floor, or he wants us to get into a new subject. Over to you, Howie. Okay, I thought Howie was in there. Why don't you sneak in one more email, Mel? K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, let me see if I can find something straightforward, interesting to... Okay, here we got another young ham. The young hams, I have an attraction for young hams, I guess, lately. Seems like I am getting a number of them. I got a box here that one of my Elmers is no longer active. That he found it to be extremely, I think he meant useful, he abbreviated it, something can come out right, extremely useful for matching dipole antennas to the feed line. It's called the W2FMI MT, M like in Mike, T like in Thomas, U like in United, MTU. What is it? I think I know what it is, Dick, but I'll let you take it first, and then I'll see if I can come up with what I think it is, Dick. Over.
W2FMI was Mr. Jerry Civic, a man in New Jersey who still has some very nice CD-ROMs you can buy. His main subject was balanced and electrically small antennas. Had a whole series of articles in QST Magazine in the mid-70s and early 80s on making very small ground plane antennas with ferrite and powdered iron matching techniques. So Jerry Civic has a whole series of articles you can read and buy CD-ROMs on for compact discs that'll give you lectures on his subject of various kinds of balancing and simultaneous impedance matching. So I'm not quite sure what the MTU stands for, but when it comes to feeding a dipole, my favorite technique is to choose whatever is your favorite method of feeding the dipole. I don't care if it's delta match, gamma match, T match, folded dipole, or whatever. By adjusting the length of the dipole, you have complete control of the resistive component of impedance, anything from 1 ohm to 2,000 ohm. If 50 or 75 or 300 is your favorite, you adjust the length accordingly. once you adjust the length of the dipole, I don't care if it's a dipole in the middle of a Yagi or if it's a dipole in free space up in the trees, doesn't matter. Once you adjust the length of the dipole to get the resistance, that's the right number for your cable. In general, there will always be a reactive component left over. And there's a very simple set of techniques that are in that article that you can see on the WA1MDA.org website, which will explain to you how to get rid of the reactive component. So step by step, you can make your dipole a perfect impedance match for your particular cable. So the guys out there that are experimenting with double and triple and quadruple folding techniques and all kinds of things to try to make a dipole give them a good impedance match, you don't have to do anything anywhere near that elaborate. In general, if you're a purist and you're feeding a dipole with coax cable, you want to use a balancing device of some kind. It doesn't stop it from working if you don't use a balance, just that your outside shield of the coax cable will become part of the antenna if you don't use a balance. Not a showstopper. It's a little bit of an annoyance, and it could create a little bit of TDI in some circumstances. It'll make your radiation pattern a little bit more complicated. So if you don't use a balance, nothing's going to crash. If you do use a balance, and if it's a good balance, and it can be a simple poor man's balance of a few turns of the coax at the end held together with tie wraps or with electrical tape. But one way or another, when you build a balance, if you decide to build it with toroid and ferrite techniques, you can be doing impedance matching at the same time. So what's the best way to go? I'm not sure that I want to go through all the elaboration of hanging a toroid out at my antenna, a chunk of ferrite, that is not weatherproofed. The kind of ferrite that's inside of the commercially made balance, which is automatically inside of a piece of PVC tubing, and it becomes a mechanical support for the antenna, and it's not too expensive, that's a very convenient device. I like that. But if I'm going to homebrew that and weatherproof it to do toroid or ferrite-like impedance matching as well as balancing, I'm not sure I'd want to do that at the antenna. Jerry, Mr. 2FMI, was doing it at the base of his vertical ground plane antenna, and that's a very convenient place to put a little doghouse and put the things in it. If you hang the dipole 60 feet in the air, it's not quite as convenient, in my opinion, but that's an opinion. There are guys who have done it by that technique, and they're very successful and very happy. Now, I'm not quite sure what the MTU stands for. So you're going to have to bring me up to speed on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Hey, this is K2KEY. Well, the W2FMI MTU was basically a multi-tap unit. Was meant to match unbalanced to unbalanced. And I can say it was made with a, if I remember correctly, it was a ferrite, half-inch ferrite rod size. And it had a tapped, wound with a tapped, every turn had a tap on it. And then there was in between, it's like overwound. It was, in other words, it was with two windings on there. Basically what we call bifile, a tri-type transformer. So I believe that's what he's talking about. And it was made to match things like, 50 to about 200 ohms. And I can remember it vaguely, you know, but it was basically 1-to-1 or 1-to-4 transformation ratio system. And so you selected the taps, and it was basically it was for testing the MTU. Once you established which tap was for your dipole, in other words, as the height of your dipole above ground varies, the D point peak will change. So what happens is you may want to, you know, find, there was a chart that more or less gave you what the height of your dipole, that band, and that band, that's what you needed to match it. And so you take this gadget, this MTU, and select the right tap and try it out. So And I know what he's talking about. This is basically what it was called, the multi-tap unit tick. I'm trying to recall all the, you know, the details of it, over.
That sounds accurate. If you go to the appropriate chapter and graph in the ARL antenna manual, antenna book, you will find a graph that tells you the impedance of a dipole versus the number of wavelengths the dipole is above the ground. To your and my eyes, that ground out there is dirt, grass, sidewalk, and whatever. To a wave at 20 meters, that sidewalk and dirt and ground is almost a perfect mirror. There's a real antenna above the ground, there's a mirror image of one below the ground, and they're out of phase with each other because the horizontally polarized wave striking the ground experiences a phase reversal on reflection. So the two antennas, the virtual one below the ground and the real one above the ground, are out of phase with each other. As such, when you vary the altitude of your antenna above ground in wavelength, the impedance goes up and down a little bit, it wiggles. And there's a graph that'll tell you that. And so once you know what impedance you're going to get out of the antenna, you could tune it for that impedance. You could calculate ahead of time how long it should be, how much reactance is going to be, if you use my tuning technique. You could calculate how many turns of the multi-tap unit of Mr. Jerry Civic, W2FMI. You can calculate how many turns will give you the right impedance match by that technique. The problem you and I are creating, Mel, for the new amateur, is not that we're not giving them ways to go. We're giving them too many ways to go. An awful lot of the emails that you're getting and that I'm hearing about lead me to believe that a new amateur has too many choices and he's confused. When it comes to buying a transceiver, he's got 10 models and five brands. And which is the right one for him? When it comes to antennas, there's a bunch of antennas. When it comes to feed lines, there's a bunch of feed lines. When it comes to impedance matching, there's a bunch of impedance matching. And so a new amateur says, I want to have the best transmitter, I want to have the best feed line, I want to have the best antenna, I want to have the best receiver, and so on. And the difference between all of these, in many cases, is extremely minor. What you and I are really recommending is that they jump into the water, because the water is fine, there's a good lifeguard present, you and I, among others, and as such, they're not going to get into a hell of a lot of trouble. If they go to a flea market and they buy a used piece of equipment, in most cases, they're not going to get stuck, because there are people in this club, among other clubs, the Kings County Radio Club, Long Island Amateur Radio Club, Limar, any of these clubs have got smart people that will help you repair your unit if it's not working perfectly. When it comes to which antenna, the first time you put it up in the air, it has the standing wave ratio that's a little bit too high at the high end of the band, and there are guys that will advise you in this area. Jump in, don't worry about it. I mean, a new person hit with all of these possibilities at first is a little bit dumbfounded. It's the same problem I have when I walk into a brand new restaurant and I look at the menu on the wall and they got 40,000 names that I don't recognize and no pictures. I don't know what the food is. Until you've eaten in that restaurant five times, you don't know how to read their menu. The first time you're online and you finally get up to the counter and the person says, what do you want? And you look at a menu with 50 things on it, it's kind of confusing. It's kind of difficult. That's what these poor amateurs are running into. In our particular case, in that restaurant, you just say, I'm going to choose number 8. I don't care what it is. Sell me number 8 because the price is right. I'm hungry and I want some food. And you're probably going to turn out all right. They're not going to poison you. And by the same token, if they choose an antenna, they choose a rig because it's the right price at a flea market or it's on sale at their favorite amateur radio outlet or whatever, in general, they can't go wrong with a couple of rare exceptions. Particularly if you ask a couple of your friends, what are you using? Are you happy with it? Do you know anybody else that's happy with it? If you get a couple of yeses out of that, go and buy that one, and you can't go wrong. I mean, you can either study the problem for a year, or you can jump into the water in the first 2 weeks, and you get the 51 weeks of operation as opposed to 52 weeks of studying it to try to choose the absolute best one. That's a philosophy. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Yeah, Roger. Yeah, I could say it goes on and on and on. See what's happening now. We're getting a mixture of new people coming in, getting the influence of past and the present and the future. So it gets a little confusing to a lot of the newer hams coming in now. I think they go out and buy a number of transceivers from a number of manufacturers that basically do the same thing, you know, cover the same frequencies and same power levels. But which one, you know, it's so confusing when a young ham reads it over and says, gee, if I spend an extra $100, is it worth it for this one over the other one? I'm maybe exaggerating $100, but it could be a heck of a lot more than that. But is it worth it, you know? And it's a very difficult, you know, decision. And I don't know if I can even give the answer to that type of problem. You know, as far as transceivers go, they're all fairly, I'd say, great pieces of equipment, and there may be subtle differences about them that maybe only the individual would, that's going to use it really would be concerned about, the, you know, differences. I mean, it could be cosmetics and just physical size and things like that. So this is it. I've got a lot of emails here, Dick, with questions about cable, antennas, things, gadgets here. I don't even know how I can tell you how much more to take right now. Over.
That's your choice. You want to try another one? It's up to you, ML.
Okay, so we went through the MCU. I can say that was a multi-tap unit, and it was used for basically finding out which one of the taps works best, and then you ordered that from one of the sources that was producing the W2FMI series of matching networks that, of course, now I think RadioWorks took over most of those manufacturing of those types of devices that Jerry designed. So they put them in the PVC pipe so that you can hang it right up there at the dipole and connect your cable right onto it. I believe that RadioWorks is the one that's doing the manufacturing of Jerry Civic's and matching networks, Dick, over.
That may be true, but I don't know that for a fact. Mel, go ahead.
Okay, I believe so. RadioWorks, I think, specified that they were designed or using the design of Jerry Civic. I don't even know if Jerry Civic... you know, first of all, is Jerry Civic still alive, Dick?
I know that his wife passed away. I bought a couple of CD-ROMs of his in the last 6 months. I'm led to believe he is still alive. Go ahead.
Because why I asked that, because when I met him years ago, he was quite a bit older than me at the time. I would say he was easily a... about 20 some odd years older than me, I believe. So I was wondering if he's still with us. Great guy, wonderful man to talk to, very, very nice fellow. All right, let's see now. What have I got here? What's this? What do I read over here? Here's another thing on Bowel. Let's see, World Radio Lab sells an antenna made by W3MWY called the QRP Special. It was a quarter wavelength ground plate vertical bed with 450 ohm ladder line and a 4-to-1 balun connected with a short piece of coax cable. Now, do I have to use the balun? They sell the balun separately, okay? And a number of people said you could take a piece of coax cable and create a type of a coil with it and do matching by this method, by simply coiling coax feed lines to create, what would you call this? Oh, I think he's trying to say create a high XL type of configuration by rolling the coax. And is this better than using the 4-to-1 balun, Dick, over?
As I see it, Mel, they both work equally well. Now, let me go back to FMI for a second. I just looked him up on the advanced section of QRZ.com. He was born 1919. That means this year he will turn 88 years of age. He renewed his license on March 4th of 2004. His license will be in operation until 2014. So by all indication, Mr. Civic in Basking Ridge, New Jersey is in good health from what I can tell by QRZ.com. Now, when it comes to the balance required between a coax cable and a dipole, for instance, in other words, the dipole itself is a thoroughly balanced antenna. In the ideal world, if at one instant in time you feed positive voltage on the right-hand side of the dipole, you want to feed an equal amount of negative voltage on the left-hand side of the dipole. That's the way the dipole wants to operate. And you could say that theoretically, the tip of each dipole has a resistor that goes to ground, and it forces it to be balanced. Mother Nature tries to do that. That's not quite true, but if you treated it that way, it would be close to the way it really operates. It would give you a little bit more feeling for what happens. And that way, it's a balanced structure, and you try to feed it in a balanced manner. And it would be fed in a balanced manner if you were feeding it with some kind of a twin lead transmission line, like 300 ohm or 72 ohm twin lead. Most of us love coax these days, and we want to feed it with coax. Coax is basically unbalanced. That is to say, we want all of the signal to exist between the center conductor of the coax and the inside layer of the outer conductor of the coax. And when that signal is flowing down the coax, coming from the connector on the back of your rig, that signal is thoroughly shielded, all of it's inside that cable, and that center conductor touches one half of your dipole, and the shield touches the other half of the dipole. The dipole is now getting a signal between the two halves. It tries to balance itself. Therefore, the dipole itself will launch a signal that goes down the outside of your coax cable and travels down the cable back toward the transmitter. That's not bad, just that it's non-ideal. Now, how do you choke that signal from going down there? One way is to use a balancing device which has coax as the input and the equivalent of twin lead as the output, and it feeds the dipole. So the W2AU and other brand names of coaxial balance structure that you can buy from all the good ham radio supplies does the job mechanically, weatherproof-wise, and electronically very nicely. You take it apart inside, and you'll see a bunch of large toroid ferrite devices stacked on top of the outside of the coax cable inside of that PVC piece of tubing. That creates an RF choke. So you can create the RF choke with a bunch of stacks of ferrite toroids slipped over the end of the cable, or you can create a poor man's balance by taking the last few feet of cable and coiling it a few times and holding it together with tie wraps or tape. When you coil the cable, you created an inductor. If the inductor you created by its diameter and number of turns has enough inductance, it is an RF choke. It is a nearly open circuit. If you coil the cable in such a way that it gives you the right number of microhenry of inductance of the outside layer of the cable, and if that number of microhenries at your frequency represents, let's say, 5,000 ohms of capacitive reactant, compared to a 50-ohm cable, 5,000 ohms of reactant is essentially an open circuit. So that coil of wire, if it has that amount of inductance, because of the number of turns and the diameter of the turns, and you go to the right chapter of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, in the early chapters, it'll tell you how to calculate inductance. It's intended for a solid piece of wire, but it doesn't matter. You feed into that formula the diameter of the wire, the diameter of the turn, the number of turns, and the spacing of the turns. You feed that information into that formula, and that formula in the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook will tell you how many microhenries of inductance is your coil. And you go to the other graph that's in another chapter in the beginning of the Radio Amateur's Handbook, and that number of microhenries at your favorite frequency, you look at those charts, and it's a great big graph with lines going 45 degrees to the right and lines going 45 degrees to the left. It's a very busy chart, the reactance chart. But once you learn to read the reactance chart, it'll tell you that many microhenries at, say, for instance, 40 meters will have 5,000 ohms of inductive reactance, and therefore you know it's damn close to an open circuit. You don't have to go that high. My guess is anything more than 500 ohms is a darn good RF choke. So by one means or another, you create an RF choke close to the antenna. That way, no substantial amount of RF energy will flow down the outside of the cable, and now you've created a poor man's balance. It's very simple. The RF signal going down the center of the cable, the fact that it's going around the corner in a circle, it doesn't know the difference. It's only when it comes to the end of the cable that the action takes place. The only disadvantage of the poor man's balance is you're adding a couple of extra feet of cable at the end. If it's a quality piece of cable, the difference in insertion loss is something you can't even measure. Not to worry. So balancing an antenna is not a strict requirement. But if you're a purist, it's a nice thing to do. If you don't do it, in the worst case scenario, you have some RF current flowing down the outside of the cable. It slightly complicates the antenna pattern. That's not bad. For all you know, the radiation of the cable might give you a stronger signal into Africa on this particular day. So it could be an advantage. The worst that could happen is if you just happen to have the wrong length of cable, you could end up with a substantial amount of RF energy in the shack, and now when you put your lip close to the D104 microphone, a small spark jumps from the microphone to your lip while you're talking into it. It's rare, but it has happened, and the right balance will make it stop happening. K2KEY, K2LIW. Have a question? Go ahead.
Yeah, K2RIW, K2 again. I've just a curiosity. If you've got a signal that's, say, at minus 90, 2 megahertz away, now this is in the 900 range, so think it's small. And you've got something that's, say, 2 megahertz higher, and it's just one offending signal, and it's just the receiver that you're using doesn't have too much of a front end. What would you recommend to notch that out with? How would you approach that thing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. 2 megs at 900 means you're looking for a bare Q of 400 and something. To do it really right, you'd want a Q of 1,000. But to do it with a reject filter, a stub filter, very difficult. I think I would try to do it with orientation. In other words, if I can use the antenna pattern in such a way that the antenna pattern steers a 20 decibel null in the direction of the offending signal, that's the first approach. Without going to, by the way, there are very inexpensive SAW filters that we are using. There are very inexpensive SAW filters. That's the good news. The bad news is the SAW filters that are on the shelf are a band pass filter from 902 to 928 with deep skirts on both sides. Do they also make an equivalent of that SAW filter? See, the nice thing about the SAW filter is it's got the Q and it's got a whole lot of poles. So it's probably not an off-the-shelf item, but if it was, it would be a $1 item that would solve your problem. It's got the Q because of all of those damn poles, and each pole has got the Q to begin with. But for you to fabricate it out of normal materials, that's tough. My first approach would be to try to cross-polarize and steer a null with the antenna pattern at the offending signal. Does the offending signal have a known direction that you can null out, Eric? Go ahead.
No, unfortunately, the offending signal is either above or below the antenna, physically. This is an issue that I'm having. I'm linking the two repeaters together. And I've got one, the signal that we're working with is at 927, let's say. And there's a paging transmitter. It's like 60 zillion watts at 929. Okay, what I've done is I've taken a six-cavity bandpass filter and I've cheated. What I've done is I've taken the notch points on each one of them and moved them to the left and the right side to the higher and lower frequencies around the frequency that I'm interested in. And I'm able to reduce that offending signal by down to about minus 45, minus 50, but it's
the receiver that I'm using, unfortunately, only has ceramic filters in the front end. It doesn't. I don't really consider it to have a front end, so to speak. It's getting huge. Ceramic filters. They're really a bandpass filter. They're not very sharp. You know, they're pretty broad, and they slope downwardly very slowly. And I'm only talking about 2 megahertz here, so... I'm able to get it down to about minus 45, but that's the best I can do. I mean, if I go for more insertion loss, I've got the insertion loss of this thing. It's about 1.33 dB. Not bad. But it's still too much. I mean, it's not anywhere near like it was when I first started. But because paging stuff is like sending square waves into everything, it still shows up. And it's pretty annoying, but it's not as bad as it could be. But I'm looking for a better solution.
I'm going to start up assuming that the sidebands of the paging modulation are not really in your passband. Although if I did a real clear adjacent channel power ratio test, I might not be happy with the result. They could be failing their spec just by a few dB, and it would give you a lot of grief. But the filter tuning you've done, you've gotten all you're entitled to. Because the transmitter is directly above or below, there are antenna techniques, co-channel interference cancellation techniques. In other words, you could build a vertical stacked array of two antennas that steers a null straight up and straight down. That's not too difficult. With the right spacing between the two antennas and the right length of cables going into a summer between the two antennas, you can steer a null into that direction. That'll give you another 20 or so dB of improvement. After that, you've got to do something to increase the dynamic range of the receiver. You've got to put heavier bias current into that RF amplifier, that mixer, and the IF stage after it's got to have the right amount of filtering. Looks like we're about to lose the machine.
And good strength from W2L. At 8:30,
W2L. Good night, all. K2RWK2J. So you were saying. Hey, fantastic. So you've got to increase the dynamic range of the receiver as I see it, Eric, after you've done all this filtering. But you know what a co-channel interference cancellation antenna setup is from the world community TV antenna systems. So you could steer a null straight up and down and get 3 dB more gain out to the horizon at the same time.
Yeah, I understand. Well, the issue here is with antennas is that you know the sites that we're at, and to do any of that kind of stuff is kind of expensive. You know, it causes rigors to get involved, and I have to try and figure a way to do this. I mean, on the Selden machine now we have the IRLP, which is nice, and unfortunately, we may not be able to physically get it into Glen Oaks. But I have an alternative idea, and that's to, if you remember in that meeting we discussed way back, putting in plain view an Etherlink, which might be more manageable than where we have in Selden, and then we'd probably do the linking through the IRLP. I mean, at this stage of the game, I get a pretty good signal back at Selden, but... if I had a better receiver with a real front end, which we might actually get somewhere. Andy has one that he hasn't yet modified, and if we get around to that, maybe we'll have something that works better. But I'm looking for a way to get in that a couple of dB, bring that thing a couple of dB down without too much insertion loss, and hopefully the receiver will survive.
Yeah, there's two things that I would do in your circumstance. One, I would take an extremely good spectrum analyzer and really do an adjacent channel power ratio test to find out, is that paging transmitter putting the right number of decibels down signal into your channel? Because if you find out they're failing that particular test, then no matter what filtering you're doing, you're not going to make it. Second of all, I would also, if they were up at... let me pick a number, 932, I would consider moving you down to 902.5. Is that doable, Eric?
Well, these are coordinated frequencies by local coordinators, so, you know, there is that issue. And also the band plan on that band is that the repeater inputs it down at 902.
Can't you say that you use